people want smartphones. People want this and that more than ever. People want tablets all of a sudden. Every single child in the house now needs a computer.
Critical computer chips in short supply. It's Wednesday, April 14th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. You can find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Ambassador John Bolton shares thoughts on North Korea. Blocking the Mekong, U.S. lawmakers consider building plans. The future of cities. A very young comic artist. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Tech experts monitoring the semiconductor chip shortage say plans by the world's largest contract chip maker for a record $100 billion capacity expansion will just mildly dent a growing worldwide shortage of semiconductors for popular and widely used products such as high-speed notebook computers, 5G smartphones, and newer vehicles. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company said in an April 1st legal notice to the Taipei Stock Exchange that it would use the money over 3 years on leading technology for manufacturing and research and development to answer demands from the market. The notice specifically points to demand for chips used in 5G-enabled and high-performance devices. TSMC clients include multiple American hardware developers, including Apple. Kent Chung, managing director of professional services firm PwC Legal in Taipei, says TSMC's investment would help ease anxiety among clients worried about semiconductor supply chain instability caused in part by Sino-U.S. trade tension.
Overall, it would indeed increase the capacity. TSMC obviously is the forefront runner in terms of bringing the whole supply chain to the U.S.
Analysts caution the ever-growing demand for chips paired with the lag time in building new production plants will extend the shortage for years, despite TSMC's investment. Sean Su, an independent political and technology consultant in Taipei, points to the popularity of home-use devices during the pandemic and a possible long-term reliance on this technology in a hybrid online-offline economy after COVID-19 subsides.
Demand is off the ceiling. People want smartphones. People want this and that more than ever. People want tablets all of a sudden. Every single child in the house now needs a computer instead of sharing it.
Remote study and telework, two trends that emerged during the 2020 coronavirus outbreak, especially raised demand last year for chips that run high-speed notebook PCs. That trend follows pre-pandemic demand for 5G smartphones and new devices that run on artificial intelligence. Automakers joined the mix, too, as last year they placed large orders for automated vehicles and electric cars. Because of the current chip shortage, they must wait until at least early 2022, as production capacity is now considered fully loaded. Market researchers estimate world demand for chips should increase from $450 billion last year to about $600 billion in 2024. Chinese semiconductor clients are feeling an additional pinch because of curbs introduced by former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration, which barred companies, including those based offshore, from working with a list of Chinese firms considered national security risks. Most of the world's chipmakers, such as the growing China-based Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, lag in the equipment and know-how to make chips that run fast on low power. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. United Nations warns Myanmar could erupt into full-blown conflict. Japanese government approves plan to release radioactive water from Fukushima nuclear plant. India approves Russian vaccine while battling devastating COVID surge. President Biden will pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th, according to sources. Inspired by U.S. free libraries, Indonesian villagers build mini learning hubs. Expanded coverage of these stories and so much more can be found daily. Visit us at Facebook at VOA Asia and stop by our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. U.S. President Joe Biden's top advisors are reviewing and formulating their policy toward North Korea, which continues to build its nuclear arms program despite many years of varied attempts to curtail the effort. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton spoke with VOA about North Korea and recent engagement efforts. In the third of three parts, Ambassador Bolton discusses with VOA Korean correspondent Young-gyo Kim about the North Korea threat and why former President Trump failed to reach an agreement after meeting with Kim Jong-un three times.
I think South Korea really is not an intermediary in the sense South Korea is a direct participant in these talks. I think what in a perfect world, what the United States would like to see is more cooperation with Japan. I understand the historical and political reasons, contemporary reasons that we're talking about. But the fact is, North Korea is a real threat to Japan. It's a real threat to other countries, potentially in Asia and the Pacific. And I think we all should be focusing really over the long horizon of the rest of this century on what we call a free and open Indo-Pacific. You know, we've had very interesting conversations dating back even before the Trump administration with the Quad, India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. And President Biden just held the first summit virtually, but the first summit of the Quad. It seems to me there's room for many other friends to join the Quad. We're all worried about China. Nobody's characterizing this as a NATO. It's not a defense alliance. But it is an alliance, an informal alliance of people who believe in a free and open Indo-Pacific. So broader participation of South Korea in this emerging framework, I think, would also strengthen South Korea's hand in dealing with the North Korean issue, not just denuclearization, but ultimately reunification on the right terms.
What President Trump did with North Korea, it was nothing like we have seen in the history of the U.S. In the past. Why do you think Trump was able to do what he did?
He very much wanted to establish a personal relationship, not just with Kim, but with Xi Jinping, with Vladimir Putin, with other key leaders, because he believed that a good personal relationship with a foreign leader meant that U.S. bilateral relations with that country were good. That was fundamentally wrong. I think Kim Jong-un must have been astounded when Trump agreed to meet with him. He got put on an equal platform with the president of the United States, and he gave up nothing. So, you know, you can always make a deal if you give everything away. And that's what Trump did, I think, from North Korea's point of view. What Trump got out of it was a lot of publicity over the course of the three summit meetings. And Kim Jong-un got a lot of free publicity out of it, too, making him a player on the world stage. But here's the real test in considering proliferation of nuclear weapons or chemical or biological weapons, which North Korea is also pursuing. Time is always on the side of the proliferator. Time is important to overcome the complex scientific and technological matters that have to be resolved in order to get deliverable nuclear weapons. So from Kim's point of view, time works in his favor. He doesn't need to test if he's already ready to produce. What he really wanted was relief from the economic sanctions because he knew they were squeezing North Korea very hard, not because of the people. They were squeezing his regime very hard. And he was willing to trade the promise of denuclearization for economic relief. And that we would not give him.
So when you look back, from the personal relationship between the Kim and Trump, Kim Jong-un gained a lot.
I think on balance, there's no doubt North Korea won the 4 years of the Trump administration. They got legitimacy on the international scene that they didn't deserve. They didn't give anything up for it. And they had four more years to perfect their missile and nuclear programs.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking with VOA Korean correspondent Young-gyo Kim. The conversation was presented in three parts on VOA Asia. You may find all three at our website, voanews.com. Happening now in Asia, anti-coup demonstrators across Myanmar are turning the country's traditional New Year celebration into a quiet protest against the military junta, as the United Nations warns the situation there could deteriorate into a full-blown conflict. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's nice to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us. The Mekong is one of the world's great rivers, a 5,000-kilometer waterway threading from China through Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. However, dams have subverted the ecosystem and forever changed the lives of those who depend on the river for food and work. Vijitcha Duangdi reports for VOA News from Nong Khai, Thailand.
Panning for flecks of gold on the banks of the Mekong River in northeastern Thailand. 64-year-old Rotana Tebuong says the waterway has been her playground, food supply, and income source throughout her life. Now it is changing at a speed she can barely believe.
When I was young, in the dry season, the water would be so low I could walk over to the Laos side. Now the water rises in the dry season, so here I am panning for gold where I still can.
Upstream dams, many built by China, have upended the natural cycles of the river, a waterway that feeds 60 million people as it snakes through Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, Myanmar, and Vietnam. The riverbank used to provide farmland to the poorest Mekong villagers. Now water levels rise and fall without warning when the dams are closed to make electricity and the land yields little. Campaigners say fish species have been decimated, while the downstream is starved of vital sediment, sending a shock through the entire ecosystem. Locals fear a new $2 billion China-backed dam planned for Sanakam on the mainstream of the Mekong in Laos, which is less than 2 kilometers away, will be the end of the living river in northern Thailand. It is currently undergoing a consultation process, but that is widely seen as a formality. From a rare conservation area on the Thai bank, a few kilometers downstream from the proposed dam, local researcher Apisit Suntharawirat has mapped the destruction of the river.
The Chinese and Lao dams have ruined the ecosystem. Many species of fish have vanished due to lack of sediment. 69 types of fish have gone, but it also has an impact on plant species, which are the food source for fish.
Dam operators say they have taken all precautions to mitigate environmental damage, including creating a fish ladder to allow species to migrate during spawning season. But from his river view, though, Apisit says big business in China, Laos, and Thailand is wringing money from a shared natural resource.
Villagers are not getting any benefits from these dams. The only people that gain are the big business people involved.
At this small hut, a network of fishermen defends the river from the big hydropower plant.
I can't describe the strength of the bond I have with the river. The Mekong River is our river of life.
With fish stocks depleted, many fishers have left the waterway for work in rubber fields or factories in the city. For those who eke out a living from the river, another proposed dam in Pak Chum, the first across the Thai stretch of water, would make the people who still eat, live, and work along its waters destitute. Fisher Sutta carries a simple plea to the dam builders.
Please stop. I'm begging you to return the same Mekong River to us. Please don't build any more dams. Enough is enough.
Wichitra Dungdi for VOA News, Nong Khai, Thailand.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often. at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. The Japanese government has approved a plan to release millions of tons of radioactive water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. It's drawn much criticism and some opposition. You'll find this and all the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, lawmakers are returning to Washington this week with U.S. President Joe Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure package topping their agenda. We hear more from Michelle Quinn.
President Joe Biden will meet with a bipartisan group of lawmakers this week to talk about his infrastructure package to fund improved roads and bridges, faster internet connections, high-speed trains, and much more. Biden faces the same choice he had earlier this year with his $1.9 trillion economic recovery package. Negotiate what's in the infrastructure package and how to pay for it with Republicans, or go forward with the legislation with only Democrats' support. While the Senate is divided 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats, Vice President Kamala Harris can break a tie. So far, Biden says he wants to seek bipartisan support.
The president is willing to negotiate what this looks like. He knows that his current plan is going to be changed. That's the nature of compromise. So whether it is in one big package or several packages, he wants to talk to Republicans.
Republican leaders have stated their opposition to the package, saying it's too big, and they oppose how Biden proposes to pay for it, raising the corporate tax rate to 28%, up from the current 21%. It would partially reverse tax cuts made by then-President Donald Trump 4 years ago. Republican leaders say they are hoping negotiations with Biden go better than they did over the economic rescue package.
We are willing to negotiate with him on an infrastructure package, and this trillion-dollar number is way too high for me, I'll just tell you. But negotiation has to be something different from what we had on the rescue plan.
The American Society of Civil Engineers gives U.S. infrastructure a C-minus grade in its latest report. The group says years of inaction have left the country with deteriorating roads and bridges, while airports, water supplies, and public transit systems require upgrades. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, Taiwan has formally introduced a new naval warship as China's military increases its presence near the self-ruled island. Several Chinese encroachments of the island's air defense zone have raised concern of a possible attack. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the International Future City Competition recently announced its 2021 winners in the first ever all-virtual event. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
Al-Hadid School in Houston, Texas, congratulations! You did it!
Middle school students from Al-Hadid School of Accelerative Learning in Houston, Texas, won the top prize in the International Future City Competition.
Yeah, we had so many challenges, coronavirus and following the CDC guidelines, as well as like some of our team members attending school online and some going in person, and managing our schedules was all important factors, but thankfully it all paid off.
Some of our team members also contracted COVID-19. That was a big problem, so yeah, we skipped a few weeks of work too, so we had to catch up.
Each year, Future City, a project-based learning program, invites middle school students from around the world to create a scale model of a city of the future with the idea of making the world a better place. This year's theme, Living on the Moon, challenged students in 37 U.S. regions and teams from China, Canada, and Nigeria to design and build a futuristic city on the moon.
We wanted to make a city that gave citizens everything they needed and more. We also wanted to make sure that, like, in our city, it can rely on the resources that the moon is given instead of, like, having to rely on resources back in Earth.
42 teams made it to the finals in one of the largest engineering challenges in the U.S., which engages more than 45,000 students every year. Discover E, an engineering outreach group, has been running the competition for 29 years.
I am always impressed every year by the depth of research that our teams do, by how knowledgeable they become about the specific topic at hand, and how they become experts in it. Our student participants learn all about the ins and outs of engineering and city design and everything that goes into planning and building and maintaining a city, but they also learn how to work together as a team, and their confidence just grows by leaps and bounds.
Working on the projects can also inspire the students about the future.
I can take many deliverables from this project and use them in the future, such as the engineering design process. I personally want to be a lawyer, and one of the things you can do as a lawyer is going to the environment. So this definitely taught me so much. So if I do choose to become an environmental lawyer, I have so much information.
We often hear from teams who haven't ever participated that they didn't realize that there's so much variety within the field of engineering. They thought you could be an engineer. They didn't know you could be an environmental engineer or an agricultural or civil engineer.
In addition to feeling empowered, the winning team receives the grand prize of $7,500 for their school's STEM program and a trip to space camp in Huntsville, Alabama. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
9-year-old Nadja Pivoff from Boston, Massachusetts, has been drawing since she could hold a pencil. It has been especially important to her during the COVID lockdown, as Junia Dulo reports from Boston.
9-year-old Nadja Pivoff loves drawing and comics. She takes what she sees around her and puts it on paper.
This is her way of turning everything that surrounds her into characters and her own comic world. She adds humor and sarcasm, a little bit of irony, to what she sees, different situations, people, and I believe that's truly unique.
The isolation of COVID made her turn to her comics as relief. Even her math workbook is full of fun drawings on the subject. Another notebook is dedicated to her grandmother's arrival from Russia. She even created a special series on pasta, a favorite food she learned to cook during the lockdown.
These macaroni are talking to each other. And here's some person who wants to eat them. And they have no idea what's coming.
At the beginning of the pandemic, Nadja started online comic drawing classes that have turned into a serious hobby. The young artist is even earning a little from her art. Together with her mom, she decides which topic to cover and how to present it in each session. Sushkova says all the planning and practice are paying off.
She's making her own comic world deeper and more intricate. She's broadening her arsenal of ideas and tools that she uses to convey her thoughts and emotions. The faces of her characters are getting more detailed. She pays close attention to mimics. She's developing her own style, making it more nuanced.
Nadja marked the start of the quarantine with a comic about the coronavirus that arrives on Earth from Mars and dinosaurs scatter away to stay safe. Today, a year later, she's focusing on a new superhero.
I started drawing a comic about a superhero named Vaccine, who is fighting against the coronavirus. Here, he's showing everyone how cool he is.
In Nadia's imaginary world, Vaccine tracks down the coronavirus and gets rid of it once and for all. And by doing so, he frees the world and lets Nadja see her friends again in person. Jenia Dulu for VOA News, Boston.
Tuesday marked the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. We wish a very good month to all of our listeners who observe Ramadan. Our time is up for today's program, but we continue online. We're at VOA Asia Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. We hope to see you there. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our staff that helps bring the program to you, our managing editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.